This is an ABC podcast.
This is the Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Well, the future of our planet has been front and centre in Glasgow recently. And when we think about our own footprint, what are some of the first things that come to mind? Maybe it's excess waste of food. Is it your local tip and landfill or non-recyclable products? Or maybe you think about the bigger picture, things like clean energy, solar, wind, and the future of fossil fuels.
Well, around Victoria, there's some innovations and projects where people, they're thinking outside the square when it comes to that clean energy. There are people, individuals, farmers, small business people, local councils, working on ways to generate energy from all sorts of those byproducts, whether it's tip waste, pig manure, or straw on farms.
Pig manure, turning that into energy. That's something that we're going to learn about today, and I have no idea how they do it. But some people, well, they're calling this a waste revolution.
So what do you think? Would you like to see your local tip turning your waste into energy, or maybe at your local swimming pool, heating that water from geothermal energy from underground?
It's interesting when we think about what will the role of alternative energy be in our future. Or do you think we should be focusing more on reducing waste rather than reusing waste and turning that into energy?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
Talking about alternate energy, Angus Verley, ABC Rural Reporter. Of course, people might know you as well from the Country Hour, but a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour. Angus, how much do you know about alternative energy?
Thanks, Rish. Well, certainly no expert. My rural stuff I know in my role as a rural reporter, and there is some overlap as we're going to talk about a little bit later on, and as we've already touched on there, some of those things that people are doing on farms already, whether it is, as we said, pig manure or straw. I understand that people are turning it into energy and electricity. No idea how they're actually doing it in practical terms, though.
It's one good way and one interesting way to get rid of pig poo on your farm, though, really, when you think about turning that into energy. I'm not sure I'd be throwing my hand up to do it. What will be interesting to come out of today's conversation, though, Angus, is whether or not we should be focusing on, you know, how do we reuse these products, you know, when you talk about the circular economy, or should we actually be looking at actually reducing the amount of waste as opposed to what do we do with the waste? Because I think there is a little bit of debate in society saying, well, let's focus less on what we do with it and more about not producing it in the first place.
It's a great question, and I don't know the answer, but I'm assuming that it might be a combination of the two. I suppose there are probably limits to how much we can reduce our waste. So I'm assuming that these projects are focusing on using that waste that we can't eliminate. So reducing our waste as much as possible, but then once we get to a certain point, maybe taking that waste that can't be eliminated and working with that.
Steve Thorpe is the Director of City Operations at Wyndham City Council. Steve, what are you doing at your local tip there?
A lot of different things, but you know, probably the one most relevant to a discussion about waste to energy is we're looking to take source-separated food and green organics and food and green organics that we're able to recover from the mixed waste stream that comes to us from the red bins that people put out the front of their house each week, and take those organics into an anaerobic digester and produce methane, and take that methane into a power station that exists at our landfill and use it to generate electricity.
So, Steve, that's a two-step process then that initially you need to be separating out that green waste before you can go through, put it into that digester?
Look, it'll take both waste streams. So that's our preference, I think, mainly because the digestate from the digester can then be reused back on farmland or for agricultural land improvement. When we take the food and green organics out of mixed waste, that's not possible, but we can produce methane with both streams.
How do locals feel about this, Steve? I mean, is this something that many people know about? Are they happy about it? I'm presuming that many people would want changes to landfill, but what sort of reaction have you had from the community?
Look, this has been something our council's been working on since 2016 when you know, because unlike most councils, we actually own and operate a large commercial landfill facility. And in 2016, the council decided that they wanted to move away from conventional landfill and towards resource recovery. So this has been happening for a while. We have a community reference group that sits with some of our councillors and officers, and they're extremely supportive of us, stopping landfilling in the way we currently do, but also looking at energy recovery from those waste streams. And you know, many people in our community already have a green waste bin, and this is the move the state government's encouraging councils to do, to provide more bins for people to separate out their food and green organics.
Steve, how long will this take to be up and running? And then, I mean, is anything significant done with the energy that you'll be creating?
So, look, at the moment we're in the, at the beginning of the design process. So we've been through an expression of interest process to have the concept design developed for this facility. That'll come back to our council early in the next calendar year. But we're looking at having this facility operable by 2023 and taking, you know, source-separated green waste and hopefully food and green organics recovered from mixed waste. That's the plan at this stage.
And hi, Norman.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What did you want to say?
Well, it's not so much about alternative energy, but more about renewable energy. And, I was reading that just in the last few days, there's been an approval given for a very large wind farm in Victoria. I think in the Rokewood area. But there are, and this morning, quite separately, I happened to be reading about wind farms. And the comment was made that you need oil to lubricate the turbines, and that oil has to come from fossil fuel.
And what's your point or your concern around this? Is that using fossil fuels?
Well, yeah, you can't do away with fossil fuels because there are a lot of processes that need lubrication, and the turbines which are producing renewable energy, in a way to replace the energy produced by fossil fuels, in fact requires fossil fuels to produce it.
Norman, a little later we're going to be speaking to Tony Wood, who is an energy expert and is from the Grattan Institute. We might actually put, Angus, some of that to him, because, I mean, that's certainly something that I don't know whether or not some fossil fuel is still being used for wind. But wind is something that I guess we're seeing become more mainstream, really, haven't we?
Well, that's it. We're talking here, as you said earlier, the alternatives to the alternatives. So, interesting. And another point we will talk about a little bit later on is that, although in Australia these bioenergy projects we're talking about are very much niche, that in other countries they dominate and they lead wind and solar. So, in some senses, maybe we are trailing a little bit behind when it does come to bioenergy.
1300 222 774. Steve Thorpe, still with you, Director of the City Operations at the Wyndham City Council. What is this all costing, Steve?
So the initial investment in a facility that's capable of recovering the green organics is and other materials is $30 million. So that's something the council's looking at funding. In addition to that, there's about another $15 million for the anaerobic digester. And then, of course, you know, we use the methane will be used to produce electricity, so you need a passion, and they're about another $10 million. So it's a significant investment all up to be able to recover these organics and use them to generate electricity.
So when it is such a significant investment, Steve, and you're talking here, I'm assuming, about spending at least in part ratepayer money, how do you justify it?
So a business case has been developed, and this will generate a commercial return to the council. So it'll be a way of our community making sure that waste of producers are taken into the most beneficial treatment and disposal stream. But it'll also be a service that we can offer to other councils in Melbourne.
I know that there's a similar concept happening in Gippsland, and we'll cross to Gippsland a little later. There's quite a few jobs being generated from that. Now, this is an area that's going through transition at the moment and needs jobs. What sort of job market will be created by what you're doing at the Wyndham City Council?
Well, there's certainly more jobs in recovering resources from waste than there are in simply burying it in a landfill. So we're looking at potentially 30 to 50 jobs associated with resource recovery, so that would be, you know, metals and other materials as well as food and green organics.
And Steve, what at the end of the day, once it is all up and running, what portion is, I guess, both unrecyclable and not able to be turned into bioenergy? What are you left with at the end of the day?
So about half of what's coming into our landfill at the moment. So, you know, and our council, you know, I heard a discussion earlier about reducing the amount of waste. That's certainly our priority, to reduce the amount of waste our community and other communities produce. Then it's to source separate it, take it into the cleanest collection streams for reuse or recycling. But inevitably, there's residual waste that comes from households and businesses, and we're planning to remove half of the materials or half of the weight from that waste, and for the residual 50% to then be baled, which is a better way of, in the end, placing it into the landfill if that's what's required, or potentially transporting it to a thermal waste energy facility. And there are a number of proposals for those facilities to be built in Melbourne at the moment.
Just finally, Steve Thorpe, should the focus be, and a lot of community members are thinking this, should the focus actually be on reducing the amount of waste that we create as opposed to finding creative ways of reusing the waste that we create?
Okay, that would be fantastic, Rochelle. Like that's in the end, that's the ultimate solution to this problem. And look, to start with, just reducing the amount of composite packaging and ways materials are combined that make it really difficult to recover them would be a great start. Things like food waste, though, there will always be some residual food waste. I can't see people being 100% efficient using food, so recovering food and green organics and producing methane is something that will probably always be a need for.
Thanks very much, Steve. Appreciate you coming on the program.
Yeah, no worries at all.
Steve Thorpe there, Director of City Operations at Wyndham City Council, talking about what they're doing in the early stages, I suppose, of a long process, but talking about essentially at the end of the day, Rish, turning waste into energy.
When I was a kid, what was seen as a treat, which sounds ridiculous now, was going to the local tip and going through stuff that was in the tip. That's my idea of a nightmare now, as I'm sure it would be for most people. But when you actually would see en masse the stuff that we chuck out and the things that were there and the amount of things that we waste and throw out, it's quite confronting, actually, when you look at it. But it was very easy to access a local tip. Not so much now.
Interesting you say that, actually, Rhys. I'm in Horsham, and probably full credit to Horsham. I'm not sure whether this is happening at other landfill sites, but you can go to the Horsham tip and pretty much peruse their offerings in a similar way to, it sounds like, you probably did when you were a kid.
So like hard rubbish, you can go shopping, tip shopping.
Yep, there is an enormous big pile of rubbish. You've obviously got to be careful, and there are certain places you can't go, but you can essentially scavenge the pile and find anything of value. You can pay a bit of a nominal fee, I think it sort of works like, and take it home with you.
Mate, as a keen op shopper, that sounds like a dream to me. Have you found anything good there?
I'm trying to think. It's probably hasn't happened during COVID, like most things in life. So I haven't been for a couple of years, but I went with a colleague back a couple of years ago, and she got some treasures. I'm not sure that I found anything.
I sense a mission that we're going to send you on. Susanna's in Altona Meadows. Susanna, welcome.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to say?
Well, I was involved in, just with regards to waste and reusing and recycling, I was involved with the community consultation for the recycling and the introduction of 4 bins in Hobson's Bay. So that was separating the glass out, but also then we had the FOGO bins, the food waste and green bins, were being collected weekly, and they've gone back to fortnightly now. So we've got the stinky bin, which is unfortunate, but people weren't managing their red waste, which is what the Wyndham City Council are looking at doing. And I'm just hoping that we can leverage, and perhaps I'll be going back to Hobson's Bay to talk to them about perhaps investing in the Wyndham City Council tip, and perhaps they could do a combined effort, because we're back onto their council area, so perhaps we can do a combined effort for dealing with that waste.
Susanna, when you said you did community consultation, how do you do that? How do you go about that and ensuring that people have a voice? And then what was the reaction? You know, do people care?
Well, I care. I'm a member of the community, and I've been involved in a couple of consultations with Dogs for Space at the council. I'm not a councillor. I'm a New Zealander, and I don't vote because I'm not allowed to because I'm not a citizen. But I certainly was interested. They were advertising on their website that they were looking for community members to be ambassadors for recycling and to consult with the change and all of those sorts of things. So we were very much involved in that. Obviously, COVID slowed a lot of that down, but we were going to be going out to our festivals and talking to consumers about what they were doing with their waste.
Good on you, Susanna. It's good to hear from you. It's interesting there, Angus, that Susanna mentioned festivals. And actually, when you start to see different initiatives that are being put into place, I even think about my daughter's school, or you might look at your own workplace, and just those different plans that get put in to either reduce or to reuse waste in some way. I think as a society, we're definitely talking about it more.
Absolutely. And listening to Susanna there, it made me think, clearly, she's someone, not specifically on having a multi-bin recycling scheme that we're going to have, clearly she would be the one who would put effort into it. But I just wonder how it will be rolled out across, you know, generally across society. At the moment, not everyone's that diligent about separating their recycling and waste between two bins. If you add more bins into the mix, how's it actually going to work in practical terms, I suppose?
Andrew Lang is a farmer. He's the president of the Victorian Bioenergy Network. And Andrew, you're someone that Angus suggested that we chat to as well, because you've come up with a creative way of turning residue crops into electricity. Welcome to the Conversation Hour. What have you been doing?
Hi, Rochelle. It's not me coming up with the idea. It's really been done for many years in a whole lot of other countries, including the UK and Spain, and particularly Denmark to start off with. I think in 1993, Denmark, the government passed a law saying 1 million tonnes of the crop residues, the cereal straw left over that's gone through the header, and should be going to power. And Denmark had already been putting a lot of small and large square bales and rolls of straw into heat plants, and they designed them all from the beginning. But really, they were a leader in this whole thing of straw to combined heat and power. And all over Denmark, and the last one, I think, was completed in 2017, and I got to go through this, there are straw-fired combined heat and power plants using probably a bit over 1 million tonnes, and this is the sort of amount of straw that would be easily available in Victoria, and it's just starting to, you know, the concept's just starting to be picked up here, a little bit by government, but certainly by a number of different agencies.
Andrew, in practical terms, are we talking just about burning that straw, I suppose, in the same way that coal would be burned to generate electricity?
That's one, and that's probably the simplest and cheapest option, and it's important that you're using the heat, and maybe in some cases the heat can be used to be part of turning straw into fuel ethanol for cars and to replace petrol. And also straw can be used as a part feedstock in anaerobic digestion when you've got a fairly high protein, a high nitrogen feedstock like food going in. Then sometimes you need a high carbon material, which is what basically straw is, to balance it out and have it in the right little zone of the carbon nitrogen mix. And chicken manure would be another really high nitrogen feedstock. So there are all sorts of things. There was a crowd up in the Goulburn Valley area that were talking about turning 600,000 tonnes a year of straw into aviation fuel and diesel fuel by quite a proven technology. And there are other initiatives around the place.
Right. I had no idea that straw was actually so versatile, or the by-waste, the byproduct of straw. You know, we spoke a few weeks ago about it being turned into almost like what you'd imagine to be plaster sheeting for a house, and that, you know, and it being almost fire resistant and being an incredible product there. But Andrew Lang, a few texts coming in along the lines of, yeah, but burning something at the end is still burning something, and that's not great for the environment. How does that work? Would you agree?
Yeah, I was told, when I told a mate I was coming on this program, he said the first question you'll get is, what about the carbon dioxide from the combustion process? One is that with using biomass to heat and power, you're totally replacing the fossil fuel sourced heat and power, or, yeah, probably just power in Victoria's case, but secondly, heat. And the other one is that that straw is there because over the previous growing season, the previous 6 months to 9 months, it has been taking in carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So reducing the net carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by that much, and then when you burn it, you do release carbon dioxide, but it's just in that little one-year rotation, that single-year cycle. And so you can have the single-year cycle. If you don't burn the straw, it rots anyway and releases its carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Talking about soil carbon because of retaining straw is a little bit of a rubbery one because that's a whole different story. But it's not a very effective way of storing carbon in the soil. And so yes, it's an issue. But the more important thing is the sustainability. You don't want to take all the straw. You only want to take maybe half, and that's the half that goes through the header. That's the cheap half.
James from Doncaster's on the line. Welcome to the show, James. What are you making of the discussion?
Oh, hydrogen pyrolysis. It's been developed by the Western Australian University, and the Western Australian government at Woodman's Point using waste, human poo, at the sewage farm there to produce hydrogen. The whole thing is carbon negative rather than carbon positive, and it uses methane, same as all the other biodigesters that are being talked about. So instead of burning it, though, it's turned into hydrogen using the development that the Western Australian University has created, which
and is that
really
in use?
Exciting.
I mean, is this something that the university has got up and running?
There's a plant being built at the moment at the Woodman's Point sewage farm south of Perth, which will be turned on in a few weeks' time. It's really exciting. The whole thing is a commercial development plant by a company, but the technology will be able to be used all around the world to produce hydrogen in a carbon-negative fashion from each of the things that you were talking about on the radio at during the biodigesters, but instead of burning it and producing carbon dioxide, they're utilising it in a chemical process which is carbon negative. It's quite extraordinary.
That's going to be one to watch.
About.
There's a bit of a running theme here, Angus, if you notice, with our waste, you know, as in, as we just were told there, you know, with poo, you know, whether it be human waste or pig waste, or we've even heard from chicken manure, the role that quite literally, you know, waste coming from animals or from human beings is something that's getting used quite a lot when it comes to alternative energy.
Absolutely. And I think piggeries is a big one particularly. I know of numerous piggeries that, and I'm not sure again of the science, but they're generating methane. And I think that as part of that process as well, they end up with a possibly a saleable fertiliser product as well. So there are sort of numerous benefits there that they're dealing with, this enormous amount of effluent that they have to deal with at piggeries, and then also reducing their energy needs and possibly having something they can sell as well. So you can see how that, I'm sure it's expensive to establish, but I'm sure you can see how that would be an attractive proposition.
Andrew Lang, just finally, you mentioned that you've been to Denmark and you do travel the world when it looks at different ways that we can turn our waste into energy. Where does Australia, and more, I guess, closer to home, where does Victoria sit in how progressive we are? Are we taking any steps forward or are we playing catch-up?
We're coming from way behind. We're sort of, I don't know, look, the as I said to you, the first waste-to-energy plant was built in Denmark in 1903. The Danes have been using straw to energy since probably the 1950s. Similarly, the Lithuanians and Hungarians and the Swedes have been turning pig manure into methane for the English as well for 50 years plus. So something's wrong in our ability to find out about these things and develop them. I'm hearing about hydrogen, but if only people were as excited about some of the really simple technology as they've got excited about hydrogen, we'd be way forward than where we are. as a CSIRO paper in 2012 said, that with the straw that's available in the main cropping areas, about 21 million tonnes a year, you could be producing 9% of Australia's electricity, or 20% of the equivalent of petrol. So there is this massive amount of material that we just simply don't use, like many of your callers have said. It's a real problem. But all we need to do is get outside the box and to see what the smart countries are doing.
Andrew, just finally back, I suppose, on the farm side of things. Farmers will only produce straw for energy production if there's money in it for them, in the most part, I would assume. So is it actually financially viable, and is it viable as a standalone proposition, or will it require government subsidies?
It will certainly require government support and maybe a few bits of other things like market signals, but straw baled up at, say, $85 a tonne at the farm gate is the equivalent of about maybe $7 a gigajoule, whereas natural gas is currently somewhere, what you might know better than me, $10 to $12 a gigajoule. So we're, and it has been up around $15 to $18. So the energy of straw is about half the cost of the energy of natural gas at the moment without any subsidy, and that $85 a tonne is enough to incentivise farmers to bail it up and get it to the farm gate. The trick is having that reliable market going out.
That's it, yeah. It's a supply forward and demand issue. I never thought I would speak so much about straw over the last couple of weeks, but I've managed to. Andrew, it's been fascinating picking your brain. Thanks so much.
Just one last thing. They used to make straw into paper at Broadford into the 1910-1920 period. So, yep, lots of possibilities.
There certainly is. Andrew Lang, thanks. Good on
Bye.
You, mate. Farmer, president of the Victorian Bioenergy Network. Angus, we've started something here with the whole going to the tip and being able to get bits and pieces. Lots of texts saying Hampton Park, we have a methane energy production facility, but we also have a tip shop. My four kitchen chairs came from there. That's from Andrew. There's another one in Anglesey. We've got a tip shop that's run by the local community groups, different group each week. They receive the money they make from the sales. And people talking about the chairs that they're sitting on right now. I got them for $5 from my local tip. So there's a gold mine that I'm missing out on out there.
And I'm glad that Horsham's, I was worried for a moment there that Horsham may have been the last vestige of tip scavenging. So glad to see we're not alone.
Oh, you're certainly not. We're talking about alternative energies today. So looking beyond wind and solar, what are some people reusing all forms of waste, and how are we getting those alternative energies? And is this something you want to see your local council do? Rochelle Hunt and Angus Verley with you today, looking at alternative energies. And there's a lot happening down in Gippsland at the moment. Angus, a little later we'll talk about another waste to energy program. But I don't know about you, whether or not you visit your local swimming pool. It's a big deal on, you know, how's the temperature of your pool, you know, if your local swimming pool, whether or not the temperature is quite right, and whether you can ask the man or woman that's working there, you know, can you make it a bit hotter, a bit cooler?
It takes a great deal of bravery, particularly at the start and the end of the season, doesn't it, to brave the pool?
Well, Steve Piacenti is the CEO of La Trobe City Council. And the Terrelgan pool, when it comes to heating that pool, Steve, how are you doing that?
It's actually, morning, Michelle and Angus, it's actually heated by geothermal heating. So that's where the, excuse me, we tap into the... losing my voice, we tap into the groundwater at about 600 metres below the Gippsland Regional Aquatic Centre in Terrelgan, and the water comes up at about 65 degrees Celsius, and we actually take the heat off the water. We use heat exchangers. So in Victoria, you're not allowed to actually use that water in terms of exposing it to in pools, for example. So the heat's taken off it as the water comes up at 65 degrees, and then the water's re-injected further away from the site at about 40 degrees back into the aquifer. So that's the basic principle of it, and that's used to heat our outdoor pools and indoor pools, and also the air in the centre as well.
So, Steve, how do you actually access that water? I'm assuming you have to bore a fairly substantial or a fairly deep hole.
Yeah, so about... off to a good start, aren't I? About 500 metres away from the site, we extract the water. So there's a bore and local, and we visited, actually some of our staff visited Western Australia, in Perth, where it's actually very common to have a look at how they do it. This is one of the first in regional Victoria and in Victoria itself where this has occurred. And so the water is extracted about a kilometre, half a kilometre away. It's brought up some big drilling rigs drilled down into the aquifer. And we're very fortunate in parts of Gippsland, particularly because of the coal that's there, has provides a blanket, if you like, to keep that water nice and warm. And at a very shallow depth at 600 metres might seem a very long way, but that is very good in terms of being able to easily access it. And then it's extracted up, pumped to the Regional Aquatic Centre. As I said, the heat exchangers take the heat off that water, and then it's re-injected I think a couple hundred metres away from the site. So you have to have a separation between where you extract the water and it comes up and then take it to the site and then where it's re-injected back into the aquifer. So it's
it sounds relatively simple but complicated at the same time. So in terms of other councils maybe listening to this and thinking, oh, gosh, how is our local swimming pool being heated? Was it simple enough to sort of get it up and running? Do you need a lot of skills and resources and money in order to get it off the ground but then to maintain it as well?
Yeah, so there was the regulations in Victoria. We had to go through a process of getting approval because it's about extracting groundwater. There's a number of licences that are available for extracting groundwater, so we went through a process to have that approved, and that took a little bit of time. Obviously, had to do a lot of engineering and work in terms of ensuring that, in this instance, we're not actually contaminating the groundwater. So as I said, we bring it up, we take the heat off, and we re-inject it, so there's quality control issues. It is, in terms of expense, our project was around $3.5 million to deliver that. We used a lot of local contractors in that who are now skilled in doing that sort of work. It was overseen by another company who's had more experience in that from interstate as part of the design process. But as I said, local contractors did that. So there's now potential for them to do further work in this space into the future. So $3.5 million, but sounds very expensive. But for us, we actually took out a loan to do this because it pays for itself in terms of our energy savings.
Actually, doesn't sound as much as I thought it would cost.
Yeah, so within, I think it's about 9 years, that'll be paid off for us. And then we have that free energy source, if you like, into the future. And we've seen costs of gas and other power increase over time. And so for us, it's a very long-term saving. So if we hadn't have had that in place, we would have been paying around an extra $360,000 a year in energy costs. And there's also a significant benefit in reducing our carbon footprint by about 700,000 tonnes per annum. So it's a bit of a showcase opportunity, I think, for the region. Others are looking at it. It's not, obviously, the heat of that is around 65, isn't it's not able to be used for other higher intensive energy production purposes, but certainly in terms of heat exchange, it's a definite, very significant benefit for our facility.
And Steve, you said, sorry, go on.
That's what I was just going to say, Angus. Yeah, the added benefit for us is normally outdoor pools. I think you're talking about some of the cold seasons at the start of the season. Going to an outdoor pool can be pretty cold, and some outdoor pools use solar heating, if you like, in terms of pumps to heat the water through solar purposes programs. But ours is actually an outdoor heated pool, 25-metre outdoor heated pool, and indoor pool, 50 metres, as well as other hydrotherapy pool, and a pretty amazing centre there with all of those services available to the community. So significant benefit in terms of having that outdoor heated pool particularly.
And Steve, you said the Latrobe Valley, I suppose, particularly suited to a project like this with its layer of coal and that warm water beneath it. So is it really only something that can't be widely rolled out and is only suitable for particular parts of the country?
I think for us, from what I understand, it can be done in a whole range of areas, but for us it's actually more economic because of it's closer to the surface, so it's really around that depth for us. So others could do it. It just might have a longer payback period for them in terms of the boring costs.
And do people know, Steve, have you got signs up everywhere saying, you know, how's the water temperature? What do you think? Did you know how it's being heated?
Yeah, so in terms of some interpretive signage, we do have some on the side. We've been doing some promotion around it as well. Others have had a bit of a look at it to come and see how it all operates. You don't get to see a lot because it's all below ground in terms of pipe work coming up, and there's just a plant room that has all these heat exchangers in it that are state of the art.
Is it bearable? You know, when they say outdoor heated pools, I always take with a grain of salt because they're still freezing. Like, so is it
Yeah,
bearable? So
definitely. Like most of the outdoor pools in regional Victoria and across Victoria don't typically have heating, so they're used, and ours, some of ours are just used in the summer period when the weather gets above a certain temperature, we provide access to our outdoor pools. But this one is an outdoor heated pool headed by those heat exchangers, as I said, and geothermal heating. So bearable, yes. That's a pretty amazing facility.
So people should get down there and have a visit. Did you do some laps this morning, Steve?
I'm more of a cyclist, so I went cycling this morning. I'm not a big lap swimmer. I used to be years ago. Not my thing. But I know a lot of there's a lot of swim clubs and other people who go there, and some of my team, one of my general managers goes there quite regularly and swims laps on the weekends. So it's amazing. So she loves it. That's it. Pretty significant. I think the economic opportunities, if we had additional funding, we could expand that system. We could add more systems. So that's something we'll be looking at in terms of the future. In terms of, there's been conversations even around, for example, CBD, central business districts, being able to heat larger facilities and the like with the potential for combined systems. So that a number of people might tap into, because it's a big cost for one organisation to implement, obviously, but if there were potential for a combined program like that, and some of the higher intensive energy users, such as industrial users, might be something for them to think about in the future in terms of being able to do a similar sort of program.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks very much for joining us on the Conversation Hour.
Pleasure. Have a great day.
Steve Piacente, their Chief Executive of La Trobe City Council, talking there about that Nutralgon pool that's being heated by geothermal energy, which wasn't sure what that really meant, Rish,
but it turns out
it's just warm water.
I know. I actually think it's fascinating, though. I would think it would have cost more. I mean, $3 million obviously is a lot of money, but to be honest, I actually probably would have thought it would have cost more than that. Tony Wood is the Energy and Climate Change Program Director at the Grattan Institute. Tony, we've been talking about everything today, from heating pools from underground water to using all sorts of manure from animals and humans and turning it into waste, using tip waste. Will any of these become a serious and long-standing energy provider, do you think?
Look, I think the simple answer is we're not short of energy. I think it's pretty obvious from your conversations and what you just said, Michelle, that that's not the problem. The core of this, of course, is it always is, boringly, is lining up economics with the other objectives we have, which in this case is reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And a lot of these various technologies probably have opportunities, but mostly in relatively narrow situations where particular circumstances say, look, this one will work here, but when you try and put it in place somewhere else, it doesn't work. So it might be, you know, it might be because we've got a lot of that energy source, or we might be because we've got a lot of that, you know, a city is close to a regional farming area where they can bring in the straw, whatever it might be. But it turns out that most of these usually trip over. Either they're not scalable, that is, they can't be really built out to create a significant amount of energy, or they're in remote areas, or they're just fundamentally small.
So, Tony, what's the best option then to be prioritising some of these micro projects we've talked about, the heating of the Trailgun swimming pool, for example?
Yeah.
Or possibly the straw to energy, which may have more of a macro potential, generating electricity that could then potentially be distributed through the grid. So what's the best option, and what's the most financially viable option?
I guess the first thing is that most of these options have real value if we value doing something about the environment, because without that, we just do whatever's the cheapest, and that on that basis, most of these don't get a look in versus coal and to some extent even gas. Now, that's changing with solar and wind. Solar and wind now at large scale is very viable in most situations. These ones tend to be much more specific. So the addition of some sort of biomass material like straw stuff into even existing power stations is quite possible. Those companies will only do that if there's some benefit, and usually that would be in the form of either a regulatory obligation to cause them to do it, or a financial incentive such as a carbon price which would cause them to do it. And of course, at the moment, neither side of politics wants to do that. So the renewable energy, which is currently driven mostly by state-based policies, tends to end up in stuff that the government can write what's called a power purchase agreement with the supplier or the generator, and that usually only happens with significant scale, like large solar farms and like wind farms. So it comes down to the local councils to do the sort of stuff you were talking about, where maybe, you know, there's opportunities. Local schools sometimes have got either big roofs or they might have big playing fields, and you can put geothermal energy underneath a playing field if the temperature differential is enough to justify that sort of situation. But it, most of them really do simply struggle with those underlying economics.
That's what I find interesting. So often we have conversations like this, that change actually comes from local councils or from local community groups. Tony Wood, while we've got you, let's have a quick chat to Anne in Ballarat. Anne, just quickly, what was your comment or your question?
Oh, yes. My comment was that, first of all, we're looking at recycling, which is at the end of the scale. It should be refuse, reduce, reuse, and then recycle. I can see, and a lot of business people, they're very seductive in encouraging us, you know, into these projects without thinking about it. Now, if you take the straw, I'm absolutely horrified at that. If you thought about the land, the massive land, and the water it's going to take to grow straw, to put in aeroplanes. And have you thought about perhaps we shouldn't, we used to have one trip a year overseas. Now it's about seven trips a year overseas.
Oh, well, none of us are doing that sort of travel at the moment. Tony, does Anne have a good point? Because Angus, we've heard lots of people saying, well, that's really good, but what about this? You know, there's the sort of the two sides to everything.
Yeah. Well, I think probably you would, sorry, Tony, you would probably say there's no absolute solution. That we had someone earlier on say that we need electricity just in the manufacturing and maintenance of wind turbines, for example. So I suppose there's no silver bullet.
Like whatever you want, somebody will come up with a good reason why it's a bad idea. And it depends. Sometimes that'll be because of commercial reasons. Sometimes it'll be because of environmental reasons. Sometimes it might just be, as you know, a lot of people say, I just don't like the look of wind turbines. Or, I don't want this, I don't want that. I don't want disruption to my life. I don't want my production plant stuffed around by having to worry about collecting straw or pig manure or whatever it might be. Now, again, fundamentally, every technology that I can think of that we can, in terms of producing energy and getting it into our homes and our businesses and so forth, has advantages and disadvantages. And they have to all be managed. And none of them is perfect. And none of them is terrible either. They all got a role, but most of them have got a potential role to play. And the main thing here is, firstly, we need to make sure that the real economics are reflected in the way people give an incentive to do something. And that's comes back to my point before, that we've got to value the sort of cost on the damage we do to the environment by burning fossil fuels today, which we don't, or value the benefits of the low emission technologies. Now, that then means you then try and make sure that people have got that. If they've got that incentive, there's no barriers to doing this. And sometimes we put funny barriers in place, like, you know, there are certain regulations about what you are and you're not allowed to do with various products. I do agree, by the way, with what your caller said before. It doesn't. You've got to be very careful when you start mucking around in agriculture, because what you don't want to do is taking away perfectly good agricultural land for growing food and converting that into producing energy when there's a lot better way. There's other ways to do energy which don't involve that. But however, there are some cases where there's a material you could grow on land, could be used to produce a biodiesel or used as a fuel, which could be grown on land, which isn't viable for agriculture. And provided you've got those in place, I can't see any reason why you shouldn't do it. These things are opening up all the time. And the main issue is to make sure we get rid of any regulatory barriers that stop people getting on with it, and then let entrepreneurs do it, because governments will never solve this for us, right? It's going to be down to the local councils, the local farmers, the local entrepreneurs. They're the people who are going to come up with the good ideas.
Thanks, Tony. Appreciate your thoughts.
You're welcome. Thanks, Ash.
Tony Wood there, Energy and Climate Change Program Director at the Grattan Institute, I suppose. Yeah, bringing, I'm not sure, Rish, a voice of reason to the discussion, I suppose. Not that it was getting unreasonable.
Well, I always just find it fascinating, as I said before, that, you know, big ideas actually start small, you know, and they start in local communities where test runs and almost blueprints, your pilot programs are run. And I love the idea of local councils or schools. And there's a text here that says you've got to start in your home. So starting small. But we've already been to Gippsland where they're hitting the pool from the ground. But let's go back to Gippsland because we heard about a waste to energy program out in Wyndham. It's also happening in Gippsland. Edward Nichols is the GM of Masdar Tribe Australia, which is part of the Maryville Energy Waste Project. Edward, welcome. What's happening out in Gippsland?
Morning, Rochelle. Morning, Angus. Morning, Jonathan. Thanks very much for having me on board. And I really respect the comments from Anne, one of your earlier callers, and also the comments on the text line about the need for the community to be brought on side with these and to be such an important stakeholder in these projects. And really, I think, you know, the Maryvale Energy from Waste projects that we're looking to develop in Morwell, attached to the Opal Australian paper mill at Maryvale, is very much something that's sort of born out of a need that Opal has for a stable energy supply, a need that the community has to develop better processes for dealing with our residual waste, and I think a need for the community to create industries and jobs that are going to help to sustain them as that community in particular transitions from some of the heavy industry, brown coal and other jobs that they've held previously, to a new and different future. So the Energy from Waste project that we're contemplating and that we're looking to start construction in the first quarter of next year is a $650 million development that will take residual waste, so that's only your non-recyclable household and commercial waste, take that residual waste and combust it to recover the energy, both in the form of steam and electricity, and to be able to provide that electricity straight across the fence to the Maryvale paper mill. And that will help to significantly decarbonise the energy inputs for the paper mill and help to ensure that business has a sort of a long-term trajectory of sustainability for what is a true manufacturing champion for Australia.
So, Edward, how much waste, I suppose, where's it going to come from and how much electricity will that waste generate?
Sure. So the capacity for the plant is contemplated at 325,000 tonnes per annum in the first instance. And to give you some context on that, that's probably around, Victoria sends around 4.2 million tonnes to waste to landfill every year. So 325,000 tonnes out of that 4.2 million is, less than sort of 10% of that. It will come from a combination of regional sources, ideally through the local government authorities and commercial businesses in the region, in the Gippsland region, but also being brought by road and rail from Melbourne and from Melbourne Metro Councils and commercial sources in Melbourne as well.
How do the locals feel about this? And I mean, in terms of jobs maybe that it will generate and jobs for local people, not necessarily skilled people coming in. I mean, Gippsland often feel like they are forgotten about or left behind when it comes to transition, and jobs have been promised a lot of things in the past and it just hasn't come through. So what will this mean for locals when it comes to either jobs or securing a form of energy for them in the future?
Sure. So the great thing about these facilities, and I think one of your earlier callers was also talking about this, is Steve, in relation to Wyndham, that these sort of facilities are much more job intensive than the equivalent sort of landfill type operations and so on. So for us, we envisage creating over sort of 450 new direct jobs associated with this facility. That's around 400 jobs through the construction period and over 50 jobs on a permanent basis full time. But that's just the direct jobs. As you know, with these sort of large scale employers in a community like this, there's the flow on effects into the community more broadly. And so we certainly see in the Latrobe Valley that there'd be well over 130 sort of full-time flow-on jobs in the Latrobe Valley around this, and an ongoing sort of contribution of sort of around $50 million a year in the local community, and for Victoria around $100 million a year all throughout the years of operations. So it has the potential to, not only support the Merivale Mill, which itself is a sort of 850-strong employee workforce, but to also create a whole bunch of new jobs as well, which, you know, as Yallourn is closing down in 2028, we've had Hazelwood close down recently as well. You know, it's a region that I think is very, very supportive of it from those perspectives in particular.
Thanks very much, Edward. We better wrap up. We're running out of time, but appreciate you coming on the show.
Very good. Thanks for having me.
Edward Nichols there, General Manager of Masdar Tribe Australia, and talking there about, Rish, that Merivale Energy from Waste project. Quite similar, I suppose. It sounds like a different process, but similar in the fact that it's reducing waste to produce electricity in the way that the Wyndham Shire Council is as well.
And it's interesting here, there's a text from Graham, in Glen Waverley, saying that Portland actually uses geothermal to heat their local swimming pool and a number of buildings as well. So, you know, earlier we thought, and I don't want to take the wind out of what they're doing in the Latrobe Valley, that they thought they were the first there, but I think they've been pipped by Portland just quietly. Not that it's a competition.
No, but I think that probably highlights that there's a lot more going on that sort of micro scale that we talked about before than perhaps people realise.
Absolutely. And if anything else, I've had the urge now to go shopping at the local tip and find myself a bargain. So that's a good part that's come out of today's conversation as well. If you've missed any part of it or you want to share it and pass it along, please do. You can subscribe to the Conversation Hour podcast. Go to the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Take care and speak to you soon.